Hi, I'm Mike Kozer, and welcome to the Season 5 premiere of the Lost Ballparks podcast.
This is Harry Carey with Jack Buck and Jerry Gross from the beautiful new Bush Memorial Stadium. And boy, I tell you, this is some sight.
The crowd still is coming in. The bleacher area in center field almost filled. And the indication is that it's going to be a fine Friday night crowd here at the Polo Grounds.
We're underway in the first of a twi-night doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York.
The F&M Schaefer Brewing Company, very happy to be pouring it to you from Ebbets Field tonight. And there should be a humdinger.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Al Helfer with Art Gleason bringing you Mutual's Game of the Day from sunny Shy Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Just the start of things. Go pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold Schaefer or two throughout the evening.
Welcome to the Season 5 premiere of the Lost Ballparks podcast. Today, we're talking with Jack Morris.
Now he goes to his set. Kittle waits. Here it comes. He struck him out, and Morris has a no-hitter. Lance Parrish goes out and grabs him, and the Tigers get a no-hit performance for the first time since 1958 when Jim Bunning did it.
Jack Morris was a 254-game winner, a five-time All-Star, four-time world champion, 1991 World Series MVP, and a 2018 inductee into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Jack Morris.
Hello, it's Jack.
Welcome to the Lost Ballparks podcast. When and where was the first major league game that you attended as a kid?
Oh, I'm sure it was Metropolitan Stadium in Bloomington, Minnesota.
It's a chilly but bright, sunshiny day at Metropolitan Stadium. Stiff wind blowing out toward left and left center field, and also it will swirl once in a while and go to direct center field. But it's quite a poke to hit the ball out of here to the center field pasture, 430 feet.
What do you remember about that experience in that ballpark in particular?
Bigger than life experience for a young kid who, you know, played baseball. I think that's what initiated my dreams of trying to pursue it down the road. And, then it turned into a literal dream of trying to make it to the big leagues and play on those fields. So, you know, as I got older, you know, I was a little kid when our family went out there. But as I got older, we would try to get there early because along the third base line were bleachers, and then there were bleachers out in left and left center. And you got there early enough during batting practice, foul balls would go in there and then they'd fall underneath. So kids were scrambling, trying to get foul balls. And that's another thing I remember trying to get a Major League Baseball.
And this should give everyone an idea of what kind of baseball fans are in Minnesota. But in 1965, I think you're in grade school when the Twins make it to the World Series to face off against the Dodgers.
Hello, everybody. This is Joe Garagiola with Byron Sam, welcoming you to Metropolitan Stadium in Bloomington, Minnesota. And the first game of the 1965 World Series.
Your teacher brings in a TV so you and your classmates could watch the game. Who was that teacher? Do you remember?
Her name was Miss Hudek. And, she was our third grade teacher. And it was neat. I mean, it was like, those are the kind of things that solidify that drive and interest for young kids. And all of us boys told her, you know, we're going to play in the major leagues. Of course, she smiled and gave us all hugs.
What a great teacher, though. Hey, forget science, forget math. We're watching baseball today.
Yeah, well, it's the World Series. It's like a national holiday.
Yeah. I think most folks would say that you were a dominating, intimidating pitcher. Maybe that fearlessness began when you were in junior high school as a ski jumper for the St. Paul Ski Club. I remember watching the ABC Wide World of Sports intro growing up. I don't know if you remember that or not.
The thrill of victory.
Where the ski jumper goes flying off the ramp and crashes.
And the agony of defeat.
That sport was terrifying to me, but here you are doing it in junior high.
Yeah, and that was on a dare from my father and my uncle. My cousin and my brother and I were in a car with them. We were all coming back from a family event. We went by one of the ski jumps here in Minnesota, and they say, yeah, we used to do that. You kids are too scared to do that. So the next day we were out doing it, you know, starting on the smallest hills. But yeah, it was kind of on a dare, and then it became something we all enjoyed.
It's no coincidence that you end up out of high school at BYU, where there's some pretty great skiing in Utah, right?
Well, unbeknownst to my college coach, that's another reason I was attracted to BYU. I figured, you know, we don't play baseball much in the wintertime, and they got the greatest snow on earth here in the, you know, at least in the continental U.S. during from basically Thanksgiving until baseball season starts again, which is, you know, February.
Right.
And so we got some time to get up and hit the slopes, yeah.
And you had the opportunity at BYU to not only play with your brother, but I think also Cam Killebrew, who was Harmon Killebrew's son, I'm guessing, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing because you grew up in Minnesota, that were you a big fan of Harmon?
I was, yeah. He was my childhood hero. All of us kids, every team I played on, all the kids in every league, you know, looked up to Harmon and wanted to be like him.
There's no defense, though, against Harmon Killebrew when he lays the wood into one. Not unless they change the rules to allow the outfielders to play in the bleachers.
He was bigger than life in a lot of ways.
Were you able to meet him because of your relationship with Cam, being on the same team, or did he ever come watch any of your games?
He actually attended some of our college games, and I got to meet him. I actually got to meet him before that. And, of course, when Cam and I were teammates at BYU, I got to meet him there. And then he became broadcaster for the Twins, and I got to kind of get to know him there. And I consider him a friend by the time he actually passed away.
Jack, you were drafted by the Tigers in 76, and I think when Mark Fidrich goes on the disabled list in 77, that's when you get called up. Your debut came on July 26th at Comiskey Park of that year. Can you walk me through that experience, what your first impressions were of Comiskey, and looking back all these years later, what stands out to you about that day pitching in that ballpark?
Well, Ralph Houck was our team manager, and I had instructions to meet him at the hotel when I got there, and he called me up to his room, and I got to paint the picture because Ralph was, I loved him. He was quite the character. He was in his silk robe, smoking a pipe, and I thought I just ran into Hugh Hefner. But Ralph kind of gave me the ground rules for the team. He said, I want to get you in as soon as I can. Congratulated me for being called up to the big leagues and said, I'm excited to have you. I want to get you in the game as soon as I can. You know, ultimately, for the first few days, I'll probably have to bring you out of the bullpen. But I do want you to start, and we'll see how it goes. And so I knew I'd be in the bullpen that night. And going to Comiskey, two things I remember most about that experience were there was a shower in center field, and it was a hot summer day, so people were, you know, getting wet and drinking and getting wet. And a lot of guys were just taking their tops off and going in their shorts and taking a shower. Well, I thought that was kind of crazy. And then during the first part of the game, the home team hit a home run, and the lights kind of lit up like Ferris wheels, and you know, all the flashing, circling lights, and
center field exploding scoreboard. Yeah,
and then I got called in, and that was pretty cool.
And then you get a chance to pitch at historic Tiger Stadium. What do you remember about that moment, that first game that you're pitching in Detroit?
You know, it's funny. I remember my first outing in Chicago better than I do my first outing in Detroit. My first start was a few days later down in Texas, and that was all in the same road trip before we got home to Detroit. So I actually think because I was put in the rotation, and I might be wrong, but I thought I didn't even pitch in Detroit for the next couple of, we had a little mini series there, and then went right on the road again. So I might have skipped my turn in Detroit, but I do remember that it was a unique ballpark. You know, the overhang in right field, it was kind of intimidating. It looked like a chip shot that, you know, a check swing could go out there. And then there was so much room in center field that I thought, you know, this ballpark's built on a city block, and that's the deepest part, 440 with the flagpole, kind of unique. And I do remember that in order to have success there, and Sparky kind of initiated it, you know, a couple years later, was the groundskeepers would keep the grass on the infield long. It's probably the longest grass in all of baseball, because if you hit it to right, you had a chance to hit a home run. So you needed to throw ground balls as a pitcher.
Jack, your fork ball was so good. You started using it, I think, in 83. That was the first year you won 20 games. And I think you said at one point that you could tell the hitters that it was coming and they still couldn't hit it.
Well, that's the way I felt. The first couple of years, I was the only guy in the American League throwing it. Mike Scott had thrown it in the National League. Of course, Suter was the guy that we all kind of tried to emulate with that pitch. Nobody in the American League was throwing it, so I had it all to myself for a year. And then, of course, Dave Stewart started learning how to throw it, and then it became kind of fashionable for a few years until a few guys got hurt, and then they thought it was causing arm injuries, and then all the pitching coaches said, we're not throwing that anymore. But I still think it's a great pitch for kids with long fingers.
And I was watching the video of your no-hitter last night. Wasn't the forkball the pitch you threw that got Ron Kittle out to complete your no-hitter that night?
It was. That was a cold, windy day in Chicago. The sun was out.
A cold afternoon in Chicago. Jack Morris has been a very hot pitcher for the Tigers. He is three outs away from a no-hit performance.
Typical spring in Chicago, April 4th. And, I had to pitch to one extra guy because Gerwood Merrill, the home plate umpire, missed the call on Lozinski the pitch before.
Right.
And so I had to reload and face Kittle, and I was able to get him to chase that football.
He struck him out, and Morris has a no-hitter.
Speaking of 1984, that year, after the Tigers have this incredible 35-5 start, you end up playing in your first World Series, Tigers-Padres, Game 1 at Jack Murphy Stadium.
Jack Morris, however, is all business right now, and he won 19. That's the same number that Bert Blyleven won. But he was the hottest of the pitchers when the Tigers broke out of the barrier and wore 35-5. So this year, along with a no-hitter, he's had a three-hitter and a four-hitter, and he can be overwhelming.
Was that your first time pitching at Jack Murphy?
First time I ever saw it, yeah. It was home of Alan Trammell, the great friend and shortstop. And Tram always talked about San Diego. We got there. It's like, this is what you're talking about? Well, the weather's nice, Tram, but this stadium stinks.
One of those concrete donuts from the 70s.
Yeah, we were glad to be playing. That's all I can say.
You throw a complete game, pick up the win for the Tigers.
Little ground ball to first. This ought to do it. Bergman to the bag, and the lights go out on game one in San Diego. Jack Morris goes all the way, retires the last six in a row.
And then your performance in game four pretty much sealed the deal for Detroit.
Jack trying to turn in two complete games in this World Series, and the numbers make them a lock as far as winning.
You threw another complete game, this time at Tiger Stadium.
Well, we just felt we were the best team in baseball. And yet we still had to prove it to everybody because Baltimore, we felt that way the year before, and Baltimore ended up winning the division and going on and win the World Series. And that's kind of what set the tone for us in 84 is, hey, if a team that we can handle and we know we're better wins the World Series, we can do it too. And we have to show people. And of course, we got off to that great start that kind of set the tone for the year. And then it was the challenge of, all right, that's not the end of the season. We have to win the division. You know, we have to win the league championship. We've got to go to the World Series and win that. So, you know, there was a little bit of pressure, but our team was up for it. And, you know, we just knew that we could win.
It is baseball's answer to New Year's Eve in Times Square. This one, vintage 1984. Tiger Stadium in Detroit, home of the world champion Detroit Tigers.
You signed with the Twins in 1991. Gives you a chance to play for your hometown team. Didn't you tell your mom as a six-year-old that one day you would play for the Twins?
I did, yeah. And she hugged me just like my teacher did and said, keep dreaming. I said, Mom, I'm going to play for the Twins. I'm going to play in the big leagues.
And tell me about that day when you find out you're coming home.
Well, I never wanted to leave Detroit. And that was the hardest part about that whole thing. Is, you know, my heart was in Michigan playing all those years with my teammates and winning a championship, being in the postseason 87. You know, I wanted to stay in Detroit. I wanted to have that as my only team. But when it, you know, financially wasn't going to work, I just said, you know what, this is the second best thing. And I couldn't get a multi-year contract as a free agent in those days. Collusion was huge. Ended up getting a one-year deal, but I had the opportunity to do something that nobody had ever done. I declared myself a free agent again, and the MLB approved it. So in days previous to that, you had to wait your 6 years again before you could become a free agent. But because they wouldn't give me a multi-year deal, I was able to ask for free agency after the year. All my contract was based on incentives, which I was able to meet all my incentives. Had a great year. I mean, it was a dream come true for me.
Yeah, I think every kid dreams of one day putting on the uniform of the team that they cheered for growing up. Not only do you get to play for the Twins, but you help lead them to the 1991 World Series. Braves Twins, Game 7 of the 1991 World Series.
Folks, we've been wrong. We kept saying, this series can't get any better. And it got better and better and better. And now here we are with this game to mark the end of a glorious baseball season.
And honestly, Jack, I get goosebumps just thinking about it. Here are two future Hall of Famers on the mound, you and John Smoltz.
Perfect pitching matchup. Can you believe this? Jack Morris and John Smoltz. Jack Morris with John Smoltz, boyhood idol. Minnesota signed him to pitch big games like this. Atlanta traded for Smoltz to do the same.
How loud was the Metrodome that night?
Well, they say it was the loudest sporting venue ever. And all I can say is you could be 5 feet away from a teammate or a coach, and you'd almost have to scream to hear each other. And so it was loud. And that's what made it so wonderful, really.
through 9 innings, you'd given up no runs. Do you have some conversation with Tom Kelly in the dugout? Like, I'm going back out of the, does he question whether or not you're going back out on the 10th? Or are you like, no, there's no question, I'm going to pitch the 10th?
Well, you know, therein lies the greatest story in Minnesota lore, right? the manager's opinion versus the players. But TK came up to me after the 9th inning, shook my hand, said, great job. That's all we can ask. We got Rick Aguilera warming up. We're going to bring him in. And I got up and he walked away. And I got up and I followed him. I said, I'm not leaving. And I said, this is my game. I'm pitching. I'm fine. And he walked up to Dick Setch, our pitching coach. And Setch had a couple quick comments to him. And I think Setch said, hey, he's good. You want to leave him in there. DK turned around, threw his arms up in the air, looked at me and says, well, what the heck? It's just a game. Go get him. That was his way of acknowledging. I don't think, you know, we've had a lot of conversations, Tom Kelly and I, about that incident. And his biggest concern was that I would get hurt, that, you know, I had pitched 9 complete innings after, you know, a long season, all my postseason games. That was the 4th one on 3 days rest. So I was pitching on the 4th day every game. And he was worried that I'd get hurt, but it was all adrenaline. It was the emotional high of playing at home and the final game of the year. And I had a lot left in the tank. So I just convinced him, hey, this is mine. I'm not done yet. And he gave me the nod. And I can't thank him enough for that, because in today's world, you'd never see that again.
So, no. Yeah.
You know, he rolled the dice too and believed in me.
You do your part. Shut the Braves down in the 10th inning.
Atlanta hasn't scored in 10 innings against Jack Morris.
The Twins load the bases in the bottom of the 10th inning, and Gene Larkin steps to the plate.
The Twins are going to win the World Series! The Twins have won it! It's a base hit! It's a 1-0 10-inning victory!
And you've talked openly about how your positive outlook, getting rid of all negative self-talk, is what carried you through that performance, especially in the 10th inning. You didn't have a doubt in your mind that you were going to finish that game.
Yeah, and we're going to win. I mean, I remember looking up about the 5th or 6th inning at the crowd, and they were already spent. I mean, they had the homer hankies waving. There was, you know, the voices were getting less and less loud and a lot more, you know, raspy, because people's voices were gone. They were screaming. They were yelling. It was just insane. And I looked up in the crowd, and they inspired me, because these were my peers. These were my friends and people I consider from my neighborhood, right?
Right.
And I looked up and said, we're going to win. I got to do it. You know, we're going to do this. I just didn't have negative thoughts. And you're right. The self-talk was not allowed in my brain that night. Even when I had adverse conditions, I knew I'd find a way to get out of it.
And so that final pitch, that moment that you realize we've just won the World Series and this is your hometown, this is your team.
The only way I can describe it is this way, and I've said it before in many of my speaking engagements. If everybody in the world had a chance to feel the way I felt in that moment, we'd have a better world, because it was a feeling of accomplishment and fulfillment and joy. And it's like all the hard work paid off. And I just wish everybody could experience that, because I think we'd all kind of calm down and relax and appreciate life a lot more if we all experienced that.
You know, it's a message, too, to young kids who are coming up now. The value of hard work, dedication, being perseverant, and then getting rid of all of the noise in your head, the negative self-talk that we talk about. That, I mean, that is the lesson here.
It really is. You know, if I could bottle, you know, the mental approach to that game and sell it, I'd be a gazillionaire, not only to future athletes, but to business people and people in life. But the reality is, it's once in a lifetime experience. I never once in my life had that feeling again. So it's a unique situation. But I think it was all accumulative over the last month and a half of the season, the way we progressed as a team, you know, how we kind of grew as a team and started believing and then picking off our opponents one by one.
You went on to play for the Blue Jays in 92 and 93.
If you can't beat them, well, then you sign them. Jack Morris has signed a 3-year deal worth a reported $15 million.
What was it like pitching in Rogers Center? Then it was known as the Sky Dome. What was unique about the Sky Dome?
Wonderful place. Great town. Great fans. And we had a great team. We had 2 years up in Toronto, or 2 years I played on all-star teams with my teammates in Toronto. I mean, we were talented. Most talented teams I ever played on. And you know, the city embraced us. I think we all embraced the city. The only Canadian on our team was our assistant trainer. Everybody else was from somewhere else. And yet, as far as they were concerned, we were all Canadians at the time.
Did you ever get a chance to stay in the hotel out in center field?
Yeah, I stayed there, I think, in 93 for the first month until I found a different place to stay.
How easy is your commute to the ballpark? You just, you know, take the elevator down?
Elevator, yeah. Walk around the ballpark.
And did you have a view of the field from your room?
I did not. No, those were spendy rooms.
Yeah.
I was on the cheap side.
1994, I was a senior in college down in Kentucky. I grew up near Cleveland, a lifelong Indians fan. Even then, I loved ballparks. And I knew that April 6, 1994 was to be the first night game at Cleveland's brand new ballpark, Jacobs Field. So I talked a couple of my college buddies into a six-hour road trip to Cleveland just so we could say that we were at the first night game ever at that ballpark. The drive would be worth it just to watch, by the way, our newly acquired pitcher, Jack Morris. 5 hours into our trip, though, we're passing through my hometown of Mansfield, Ohio, and I think we were listening to the Indians' flagship station, which at the time would have been WKNR. When it was announced that the game was rained out, I was so disappointed. And even though we didn't get to watch you pitch that night, I think you pitched the following night. It was still a memory I'll never forget, this 10-hour road trip with college buddies, anticipating a night of Indians baseball and watching our new guy who was going to take us so far, Jack Morris.
Well, that's it shows what a fan you are. And we appreciate guys like you. The game can be quite fun, and that's a real sign of a true fan to be able to do, you know, get his friends together and do that. All I remember about that first night, and I did pitch the first night game at Jacobs Field, it was colder than cold. I mean, it felt like 17 degrees. I think we had snow flurries. It's like, this is not baseball weather, but we're going to do our darndest to get through it.
A little ways away from the creature comforts of the Sky Dome.
Yeah, you could. Well, and the Metrodome.
Right, oh yeah.
That was always 72 degrees with no wind. You loved it there.
Hey, well, Jack, listen, I so appreciate the time. It's fun reminiscing about not just your career, but some of the old ballparks that you played in, especially Metropolitan Stadium in Minnesota. You drive through that area now, and it's hard to believe that there was ever even a ballpark there.
Mall of America. There's home plate somewhere in Mall of America. You can come check it out.
Thanks so much, man. I hope you have a great day.
Thanks, Mike. You bet. Thank you.
A couple of footnotes on the career of Jack Morris. His first full year in the big leagues was 1978, pitching for the Detroit Tigers. On April 22nd of that year at Tiger Stadium, Jack was a last-minute substitution for Mark the Bird Fidrich. Now, look, in 1978, you got to remember, there is no bigger name in baseball, maybe all of sports, than Mark Fidrich.
He's won seven in a row. He is some kind of unbelievable young Mark Fidrich.
He had completely captivated the country with his bigger-than-life, quirky personality and exceptional pitching ability. Well, Jack's sitting in the clubhouse and is informed at the very last minute that Fidrich can't go that day because of an injury. So Jack picks up his glove, heads out to quickly get loose. While he's warming up, the PA announcer at Tiger Stadium lets the crowd know that Fidrich, who they are all there to see that day, will not be pitching, and instead, it's Jack Morris starting the game. The crowd starts to boo. But by the end of the game, Jack had pitched so well that the boos turned to cheers. Morris had won the crowd over and soon became a fan favorite. To give you some idea of just how dominating a pitcher Jack Morris would become, in the 1960s, no pitcher had more wins than Juan Marichal. In the 1970s, Jim Palmer collected more wins than any pitcher. In the 1980s, Jack Morris was the winningest pitcher in Major League Baseball. One final note about the 84 Detroit Tigers. Yes, that ball club started 35-5, but they also won an astounding 17 games in a row on the road. Incredible. The Lost Ballparks podcast is produced by Alex Kemp, Brian Bingert, Briggs Buckingham, John Carter, Kyle Schmidt, Mandy Zavlakis, Mike Dunn, Xavier Guerra, Mike Lipinski, and Ryan Beard. Thanks so much for listening. Looking forward to joining you again next week for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.